Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us and welcome back. Today we will explore how we came to be made of stardust. Did you know that every calcium atom in your bones and every iron atom in your blood were once in the center of a massive, extremely hot star? And even the carbon and the oxygen that make up over 80% of your body mass were also made in stars. So how did those atoms get produced in those stars, and how did they end up in our bodies today? Here to explain all this is today's guest, Dr. Jerry Clifford. Jerry, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Robert. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
Jerry teaches astronomy and physics at California State University at Channel Islands. He has a PhD from Iowa State and 30 years of experience as an experimental physicist. Tell us, first of all, Jerry, what inspired you to go into this field, and how did you become so successful at it?
Well, I'm not sure how successful, but I started as a nuclear physicist. I went to Iowa State University, and I got a degree in nuclear physics. And about 10 years ago, a university called me up and asked whether I would teach astronomy. And I didn't have much background in astronomy, but I did have a strong nuclear physics background.
Okay, so nuclear physics is the physics of the very core of atoms, which are called nuclei.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and really the interesting part to me, Robert, is that stars and the evolution of stars is all nuclear physics, because it's the nuclei of the atoms that are interacting in a star.
So that's really quite remarkable, isn't it? I mean, here is something that's immensely large. I mean, for instance, our sun has a volume that's a million times the volume of the Earth. And you're saying that what you really need to understand about a star is the property of an atom, which is billions of times smaller than we are.
Right. That's exactly right. And more than that, it's actually the property of the nucleus of the atom, which is even smaller than the atom.
Even smaller than the atom itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe 100,000 times smaller.
Right.
Yeah. So the universe has this peculiarity, doesn't it, that everything seems to be tied together?
I think so. And that actually is such a wonderful and reassuring thought to me, how we as people are inherently tied to the stars. When I go out on a nice evening and look up at the sky and I see those stars, I know that I am part of that whole cosmos because every atom in my body came from a star.
Oh, that's really wonderful. That sounds almost romantic.
You know, I teach the astronomy course here at Cal State Channel Islands, and the students are always amazed that they are stardust. That when they think of their body and they think, you look at your hand and you think, oh, there are atoms there. There's carbon. We're carbon beings. Mm-hmm. Every atom of carbon came from a star. And when you think of your blood and the iron in your blood and the calcium in your bones, every atom came from a star.
Every atom came from a star. So how did they get from the stars to your bones?
Well, the total evolution of a star, it starts out from this huge cloud of gas and dust. We call this a nebula. And the star starts out as this huge cloud, and that cloud of gas and dust starts compressing. You know, actually, I think this is funny. A star starts off as a dust bunny.
As a dust bunny.
If you think about your house and you think about, you know, I see the dust collect as dust bunnies. It's because of electrostatic attraction. Well, that's exactly what happens in this huge cloud. So that's when we start off with all these atoms in this huge cloud, and they start attracting by hitting each other. And then finally we get a small ball of these, and they have gravity, and so they start pulling more with to it, and it grows, kind of like the snowball effect. Mm-hmm. It grows and it grows, and every time it does, it gets hotter because it's pulling these particles in from a distance. So it's kind of like the way you drop a ball onto the ground, and it speeds up, and then when it hits the ground, it actually heats up the ground or the ball. Well, that's what happens in a star.
So all these dust bunnies get pulled together by the gravity, and they heat up, and I guess finally they get to be extremely hot.
Right, and we're talking about tens of millions of degrees. So this star now is being formed, and then besides getting hot, it usually rotates, and that's why we have a rotating solar system around our star and rotating galaxies. So we now have this star that's forming, and it's made up of all this gas and dust.
So tell me, Jerry, how long does this process of the star collapsing actually take?
It takes millions of years, Robert. I know that sounds like a long time for humans, but it's actually just a snap of the fingers for astronomical time.
And so when the star collapses to a certain point, it becomes, I guess, a true star.
Right. So you've got all these elements that formed the star, and the elements came from this cloud. And the elements consisted of the most basic elements of hydrogen and helium, and also trace elements. And I think this is really an interesting part that many people don't appreciate, and that is stars have lives. Stars are born, they live a life, they typically burn hydrogen during that most of their life, and then finally they die. And when they die, they give up all of their matter back to the cloud. So it's interesting that we think about, you know, from dust to dust.
Yeah.
In reality, that's what's happening. We start from a cloud, we build a star from that cloud. The star lives a life, and it dies, and all of that star dust goes back into the cloud.
So this is somewhat like a living organism on Earth, from ashes to ashes.
Right, that's exactly right. I think that's fascinating how we have that analogy here.
Uh-huh, and it lives a life of brilliance.
Yep.
Burning all that hydrogen.
Yeah, so what the star...
Lighting up the universe.
Right, it lights up our life too, doesn't it?
It does indeed. I mean, we wouldn't be here obviously without our sun. So,
yeah.
So the collapse of all this material, which you say are the ashes and the dust of previous generations of stars, eventually collapses enough to become a new star. And what is the moment when it can be really called a new star?
Well, it becomes a new star when the heat gets sufficiently high. Over 10 million degrees in the center of this cloud, that hydrogen fusion takes place. That's where we take two nuclei of hydrogen and we actually push them together. And the reason you need a lot of heat, a lot of temperature, is because these nuclei have to be moving very, very fast so they can collide and finally fuse together. Because normally they want to stay apart because they're what we call charged particles, and they don't like to get together.
Okay, so two hydrogen nuclei, and they each have a positive electrical charge, so they'd like to push each other apart. Like charges repel each other. But you're saying because they're so hot, they're moving very fast, and is it just by chance that they might hit each other at those speeds?
Well, the density inside this what we call protostar is quite high, so the probability of them hitting each other is quite high at the densities inside this the center of this cloud.
Okay. And so if they hit each other in the right way, then perhaps they will fuse and create some new nucleus.
Right. They'll go through a process where they fuse hydrogen. Actually, they take four protons or four hydrogen nuclei, which are protons, and they produce one helium nucleus.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could weigh those, if you had a scale that could weigh four hydrogen nuclei, mm-hmm. and you could weigh one helium nuclei, you would find that they're slightly different weights. And the difference in the weight is the energy that the star produces. This is Einstein's E equals MC squared personified.
Ah, Einstein again.
Yeah, your friend.
My friend, yes. Your friend too.
Yeah.
So it must be that the helium nucleus weighs a little bit less.
That's right. Yeah, the helium nucleus weighs a little less than the four protons.
Okay, and that slight decrease in mass is converted into energy, and that produces the energy that's released in this hydrogen fusion process.
Right, and our sun burns about, when I say burns, it's a nuclear reactor, if you like. It burns about 600 million tons per second.
600 million tons per second it burns.
Is that right, Robert? Is that the right number?
I think it's very close to the right number. I'm not sure how precisely the number is known, but that's certainly in the right range, yeah. 600 million tons per second.
That's a lot of burning.
Yeah, that's a lot of burning.
And that's what keeps us warm. I mean, when you think of it, it is all of that energy that is heating the whole solar system.
That's the only thing that the sun does that generates energy.
That's right.
Is to convert a portion of that 600 million tons into mass every second.
And it's actually a very small percentage that it's converting.
Mm-hmm.
It's like less than 1% of the total energy is going into the heat that we feel.
Mm-hmm. I think it's about 4 million tons. Yeah, so it's about 2/3 or 3/4 of 1%. So 600 million tons of hydrogen gets converted into 600 million tons minus 4 of helium, and the 4 goes into making all of that energy that the sun is obviously putting out every second. I mean, here we are 93 million miles away, and if you don't put sunscreen on, the sun will burn your skin, right?
Right.
Yeah. So it must be a pretty intense fire.
That's right. And so the star is going through this process, and our sun is about 4.5 billion years old, so it's been doing that for about 4.5 billion years, and it'll just keep doing this for our sun maybe close to another 5 billion years, a little less than that.
Hmm.
And so it spends most of its life burning the hydrogen.
Hmm.
But then, near the end of its life, it changes. Used up all this hydrogen in the center of the sun, the center of its core, and then it starts this process of dying. It actually goes through these death throes where it then burns helium, and then finally it tries to burn carbon, but probably our sun isn't going to be hot enough to burn carbon. So the sun will go through a process of, it'll get larger and smaller and larger again. And this is what gives the stars a lot of their color. For example, if you look out at stars and you see a red star, like in the Orion Nebula, you see there's a star called Betelgeuse. It's a giant red star, and it's a star that's near the end of its life.
So what will happen to our sun when it gets to be a red star like Betelgeuse?
Well, when it finally gets to that stage, the star is now near the end of its life, and the star cannot support burning carbon. So what happens then is the star gets very large. In fact, it's so large that the sun would actually be large enough to include the orbit of the Earth. So we will by that time, of course, Earth will not have people long before that because of other issues, but the sun will finally be so large it'll completely envelop us. And then, because the gravity is so low on that star, much of that star, a fourth of that star, will just kind of blow off into space, into what we call a planetary nebula. This is where much of that star dust goes back into the cloud, and for the future stars to be made from.
So when stars come to the end of their life, they just don't go quietly into the night.
Depending on the stars, but at least the stars like our sun, they go relatively quietly when the cloud of gas goes out. It's not like an explosion, but it's pretty energetic, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then what happens is the center of that star, which is the core, it now will, in a matter of less than a second, shrink down, because finally gravity wins, and this core will shrink down and become the whole core of that star will be the size of the Earth. So what started as our sun now is the size of the Earth.
So that's a million times smaller.
Right. And it's amazing. And not only is it smaller, but it's now spinning very, very fast.
And it must be extraordinarily dense if that much material gets squeezed into such a small volume.
Right. And it's very hot. It's what we call a white dwarf star. So that is the end of a star like our sun,
mm-hmm.
a white dwarf.
And most stars are somewhat like our sun, aren't they?
Most stars are. I would say our star is kind of an average star. How we categorize stars is by their size. It's actually the amount of mass in a star that determines what kind of star it is. So ours is a rather small star, and all stars about our sun size and smaller, which is like over, I think, 90% of all stars are that order of magnitude. Hmm. They'll end up this way.
Hmm. And so they'll all become white dwarfs.
Right.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking with Jerry Clifford about stars and why we are made of stardust. So what happens to a white dwarf?
Well, a white dwarf now, it really depends on what's around it. It turns out, Robert, that most stars are not made like our sun as single stars. Most stars are made in pairs, called binary stars, or groups, maybe three stars.
Mm-hmm.
And if, for example, that our sun were around another star, like a binary star, then a white dwarf can actually come back alive by stealing hydrogen from its companion star. And then this white dwarf will come back to life, what we call a nova, which is a huge burst of energy. Lasts for a short time, maybe weeks, and it might do this several times over thousands to hundreds of thousands of years. And finally, when it finally gets to a mass equivalent to 1.4 solar masses, that's when the excitement comes, because that star now finally explodes in a huge supernova event.
Ah. That's what a supernova is.
Well, there's actually many kinds of supernova, but this is one that's produced by a white dwarf. White dwarfs are really interesting because we understand exactly how much energy a white dwarf puts out.
I think you mean a white dwarf supernova?
Yeah, a white dwarf. We know exactly how much energy a white dwarf supernova puts out because it started at exactly 1.4 solar masses in energy. So we know exactly how much energy it's going to put out when it explodes. And when it explodes, it puts out as much energy as all the stars in a galaxy, but over a short period of time.
All the stars in a galaxy, so that might be 100 billion stars or maybe even more.
Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. So the white dwarf can pull mass off its companion star, and with that extra mass, it will have a nova explosion, and this could happen periodically over a very long period of time. And as it is doing this, it's gradually gaining mass. And eventually, it reaches this magic number that you mentioned, Jerry, of 1.4 times the mass of our sun. And at that point, the explosion is even more dramatic than a simple nova, and it becomes a supernova that could be, as you say, as brilliant as an entire galaxy.
Right.
Now, this is what happens to stars that become white dwarfs. And you said that that was 90% or more of all the stars that we see in the galaxy. What about the other 10%? What kind of stars are those?
There are large stars. Remember, I mentioned that most stars are categorized by their mass. You have large stars, stars that could be 10 times to 100 times the size of our sun. And those stars are really interesting because their life is quite a bit different at the end. Instead of ending with burning hydrogen and then helium and ending at carbon because the star isn't hot enough, these stars are so big and there's so much heat inside that they can go beyond carbon and they can burn carbon up and then additional elements all the way up till they get to iron. And when they get to iron, the star can't burn any more elements because that's the most stable element. And at that time, and incidentally, that process takes a very short time from burning carbon to the supernova event, which it finally ends up in, can take, we're talking about hours of time, not years. And when it gets to an iron core that collapses in the supernova in less than a second, whole star collapses.
That's an amazingly short period of time for something as big as a star. It must be moving at a tremendous velocity.
Oh, it is great. And when this happens, all of that star, or most of that star, is blown out into space again so that all that star material can be used for the evolution of new stars.
So the carbon and the oxygen and the iron and these other elements that are created in the star, a good portion of those elements are blown out into the cosmos by the death throes of the star at the end of its life.
Right. And that's where all the elements that make us, made the Earth, make our atmosphere, it all came from the star.
So the calcium and the carbon and the oxygen that we breathe were all, at one point in time, atoms in the center of a giant star.
That's right.
And they were extremely hot.
Yeah. And one of the ways we know this, Robert, people ask, how do you know this? Well, one of the ways we know this, the way the stars evolve, is we look at the elements on Earth, and we say, oh, how many elements, or even in the whole solar system or the universe, and we say, how many elements are there? And we try to look at the portions of elements.
Mm-hmm.
And by knowing the abundance of elements, and we look and say, oh, there's more of this than there is of that, from that we can determine that this is the way stars evolve. In other words, the abundance of elements matches exactly with our theory for how stars evolve through this nuclear process.
I see. Okay, these elements are thrown out into the cosmos, out into the interstellar gases by the death throes of these stars, and then I guess they seed these gas clouds that you were talking about in the beginning, which collapse to make new stars sometime later.
Right.
And new planets also.
And planets, everything that forms around that star.
So the Earth itself doesn't have any helium in it to speak of. I mean, it's an extremely rare element on Earth. And it has a few percent of hydrogen in it. And all the rest of the atoms in the Earth are mostly much heavier elements, including carbon and oxygen and a lot of iron in the core of the Earth.
Right.
And all of that was created in a star.
Right.
So the entire contents of the Earth, basically, were once created in the center of an extremely massive, very hot star, and only because that star died and exploded and spread its wealth throughout the cosmos do we exist today.
Right. And so if anybody has jewelry that might have silver or gold in it, all those elements, anything heavier than carbon, came from one of these giant stars that ended up in a supernova event.
Hmm.
And what's also fascinating is if you think about the time frame, here's a neat thing, Robert. If you think about the time since the Big Bang, the time since the universe started, think of that on a cosmic calendar. So we're talking about 14 billion years, and we have 12 months, so it's about a little over a billion years a month.
Mm-hmm.
So if you say that the universe started on January 1st, the Big Bang, our sun didn't start until sometime in September. So from January through September, many stars, they were born, they lived, and they died. And every time they did that, they produced more and more elements beyond hydrogen and helium. And one of the ways we astronomers tell the age of stars is by looking at how many trace elements there are in that star. Because a star that was born early in the universe's history would have very few trace elements. And stars that are born today have had 14 billion years of recycling going on, producing all these trace elements.
So living things like us and even the Earth itself couldn't have existed billions of years ago until all these vital elements were produced by previous stars.
That's right. That's exactly right.
So we were born at the right time because we couldn't have been born before.
Well, that's probably true. I don't know how much before, but I mean, you're right. And isn't that a fascinating idea as to how miraculous it seems that this whole process takes place?
So not only are stars evolving, I mean, you talked about the life cycle of stars and how, in a sense, it seems similar to the life cycle of living organisms. Not only are stars evolving, but the universe is evolving as well.
Yes.
In part because the stars are increasing the amount of these vital elements like carbon and oxygen in the universe as the billions of years go by.
That's right.
Or the months on your cosmic calendar.
Right. So we are now on December 31st at the last second of the day on this cosmic calendar.
So, Jerry, you told me once that the evolution of stars is something that makes you feel very optimistic about the cosmos. So what did you mean by that exactly?
That's a great question, Robert. I want to remember a great astronomer named Carl Sagan. Carl Sagan from Cornell University. And he did this show called The Cosmos on PBS, excellent show. And he described the Earth as the pale blue dot. So we were a speck of dust among the cosmos. And I think that's a wonderful thought, because when you think about it, we are just one little part of the entire cosmos, and the cosmos operates and continues. It's reassuring to know that the entire cosmic engine will just keep purring along for billions and billions of years. To me, that's very reassuring. I feel confident knowing that.
You know, I think too much has been made about our insignificance compared to the vastness of the cosmos. Many people seem to feel that what science has shown is that we are unimportant in the grand scheme of the universe, as great as it is. And I really don't agree with that. I think that what science has shown, rather, is that we exist at just the right time, on a spectacular planet, at the perfect distance from the best kind of star, and in the optimum location of a favorable galaxy, and in a universe with a perfect geometry, and that we are made of the rarest and most precious ingredients in our universe. And as far as we know, and probably as far as we will ever know, we are the finest creation of that universe, and its only creation that can comprehend it. And I think all of that makes us very special indeed. Well, Jerry, we covered an awful lot today about stars. Certainly, we have to look at stars much differently now that we know that we are indeed made of star stuff, that stars are born, they live, and they die, somewhat like people do, and that stars are in many ways responsible for the evolution of the universe and will continue to make the universe a place where life can exist for the indefinite future. So, Jerry, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Robert. It was my pleasure. And next time you go outside and look at those stars, I want you to remember that we are all star stuff.
Thank you for tuning in today. And join us again next week when we'll talk about energy and the environment with Dr. Rhys Halter. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.